Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Eve Elliott, and I'm the Director of Law Student Co-op and Fellowship Programs and a Senior Staff Attorney with Veterans Legal Services. VLS is a nonprofit legal aid organization that provides free and comprehensive civil legal aid services to income-eligible military veterans in Massachusetts, including with their family law issues. And I'm joined today by Kate Berry from GBLS. Kate?
Hi, I'm Kate. I'm a senior attorney in the Family Law Unit at Greater Boston Legal Services. We are also a civil legal aid organization. We provide family law assistance to low-income individuals, primarily survivors of domestic violence in Greater Boston. And I'll turn it back to Eve.
And we're here today to talk to you about child support and alimony. So first, turning our attention to child support. So who pays child support? The purpose of child support is that it's a cash payment for the expenses and needs of a child, and a child is a person who is under the age of 18 or between the ages of 18 and 21 if they're dependent upon a parent for support. It can also be an individual between the ages of 21 and 23 if they're enrolled in an educational program. So all parents are responsible for support of their children from the date of the child's birth. If an individual is divorced, separated, or a single parent of a child under the 18 and the child lives with that parent is entitled to receive support from the other parent. This also includes grandparents, guardians, or individuals who have custody of a minor child and the child is living with them. However, custody must have been determined by the court. This also includes parents who were never married, but paternity must have been established by the court. And these are the statutory authorities for child support for those different parties. So how is child support calculated? The amount of support to be paid in Massachusetts is dependent upon the child support guidelines. Those guidelines are reviewed every 4 years. The current version was enacted in 2023. The first link on here is a link to those child support guidelines. I highly recommend reading them. They give the methodology and reasoning for how child support should work, include citations to case law and information about what to do in particular situations, including if there's income from a second job, a prior support order, things of that nature. So how do you calculate the guidelines? Well, the guidelines come with a child support worksheet, which is the third link here, and you take the information from the financial statements that the parties file in the case and plug that information into the child support worksheet. It takes into consideration each party's weekly income, the current parenting time arrangement, whether that's two-thirds or one-third parenting time or 50-50, and the age of the children. It usually goes down once a child turns 18 and also includes healthcare costs, childcare costs, and if there are any other support orders for any other children. It's important to keep in mind that the definition of income under the child support guidelines is extremely broad and includes income from all sources except needs-based benefits. And needs-based benefits includes things like food stamps, SSI, or Massachusetts General Laws Chapter 115 Veterans Program. It's still, however, important that these benefits are listed as income on the financial statement. And it's also important to keep in mind that the child support guidelines work off of gross income, meaning the income before taxes. There is also a minimum order, because as we said before, all parents should support their children. And the guidelines recognize that everyone needs to pay, but that may be difficult for some parents. So the most recent guidelines, which was passed in 2023, as I mentioned, reduce that minimum order from $20 per week to $12 per week. And the ultimate goal is for the child to have a similar standard of living in both households. So how is it paid? So the orders can be paid either on a monthly or a weekly basis, and usually they're paid through the Department of Revenue, the Child Support Enforcement Division. And DOR is the agency in Massachusetts that's responsible for enforcing child support. So the custodial parent usually signs up for DOR services, and DOR can send the withholding order directly to the employer, meaning a court order directly to the employer. And then that employer will take the money directly out of the non-custodial parent's paycheck and send it to the custodial parent by an electronic funds transfer. DOR can also keep track of what is paid and what is currently owed. However, it's important to note that the employer is not required to deviate their pay schedule. So if they do, if it's a weekly order, it still might be paid on a biweekly or a monthly basis, depending on the employer's pay schedule. It's also important that if someone is ordered to pay through DOR, that they do that and do not pay outside of DOR. It can be the child support may be paid outside of DOR if it's determined that it's in the child's best interest or the parties otherwise agreed to do so. But never paying cash, a non-custodial parent should always use Venmo, check, money order, or funds transfer, and keep copies of their receipts. So what to expect when you're going to court on a child support issue? So if you're in court on either a motion for temporary orders after filing a complaint for divorce, paternity or custody support and parenting time, you may be there for a motion for temporary orders, a motion for further temporary orders, a pretrial or a status conference or a pathways conference. In any of those cases, you're going to want to have an up-to-date financial statement and also attach copies of the guidelines worksheet that you've calculated based on the financial statements for the parties and what you believe the support amount should be. And it is possible to have multiple different versions of those guidelines. It can be possible to have different ideas as to what counts as income. Some common gray areas include complicated like compensation structures, or if there's income from a second job that was obtained after the child support order, if the job was taken to help pay the support, or if there are disputed expenses such as health insurance, childcare, et cetera. It's also possible to deviate from the guidelines. So sometimes the court will order an amount that's different from the guidelines. However, if they do so, they must give a good reason for doing so. And there's this specific deviation form here that must be completed and signed by the judge. Some examples of circumstances under which it might be necessary to deviate include if there's extraordinary travel expenses for parenting time, or if there's an inability for one of the parties to support or to self-support, or if an order is unjust, inappropriate, or not in the best interests of the child. And as I said, the court's required to make specific findings and indicate why it's choosing to deviate from the order. So I mentioned DOR briefly before. They're the 4D agency that's responsible for enforcing child support in Massachusetts. This is their website, and they're chartered under the Federal Office of Child Support Services. Their governing statute is Mass General Law, Chapter 119A, and they assist with the establishment, enforcement, and modification of orders. They can help establish paternity via genetic marker testing when necessary. And although they do have attorneys who may assist the parties during the course of a child support case, it's important to keep in mind that they do not represent either one of the parties. They also have a large number of cases, so sometimes it can take a little while for them to act on your case. They also can be responsible for filing for support, complaints for to establish child support for children who are receiving public benefits in full service or subrogation cases. They're extremely helpful with interstate cases or UIFSA cases under Mass General Law, Chapter 209D. So when support is being established between multiple for parents who live in multiple different states. You do have to apply for their services online on their website, and you'll get an online account where you can keep track of what's owed and how much has been paid, things like that. There was a recent CLE by the BBA back on March 4th where DOR presented all about their services, and I encourage you to check that out. So what happens if the non-custodial parent isn't paying their support? Well, then the custodial parent is going to want to file a complaint for contempt, and that can be filed either by the Department of Revenue or by the custodial parent. However, you will want to wait until that non-payment is persistent and the non-custodial parent has repeatedly fallen behind or fallen behind drastically. The Department of Revenue also has a variety of enforcement measures. This includes like tax rate refund intercept. They can intercept lottery winnings. They can revoke professional or driver's licenses. They can suspend passports under the federal passport suspension program. They can levy on bank accounts, and they can also attach property. So it's important not to fall behind on child support. It's a debt unlike anything else. It cannot be discharged in bankruptcy, and there can be both civil and criminal penalties, such as incarceration or the order of a purge amount to prevent incarceration if someone does fall behind in their support. DOR can also automatically collect 125% of whatever the current order is in the event that the non-custodial parent does fall behind a certain amount. Also important to keep in mind that lack of parenting time is not a defense to the non-payment of support. So when does child support end? So emancipation is governed by Mass General Law, Chapter 208, Section 28. And a court may order that the non-custodial parent continue to pay support beyond the age of 18 in certain circumstances, such as if a child's not yet 21, lives with a parent, and is principally dependent upon that parent for support, then the court may enter orders for support and education, meaning school expenses for the child. For children between the ages of 21 and 23, a custodial parent is able to obtain child support if their primary residence of the child is in the home of the parent and the child remains dependent upon that parent for support due to enrollment in certain types of educational programs. So this is for most children who are attending college. There are also exceptions that can be made for disabled children, particularly those over 18 who have an inability to self-support, then the orders can continue past the age of emancipation. And this is something that we will frequently go to court on a complaint for modification or a joint modification in order to stop child support due to the emancipation of a child. And DOR will usually stop their orders by operation of law, I believe, upon the child's 21st birthday, which is included in most of their orders. So when to file a complaint for modification? So you have a child support order, but you need to change that. So you want to file a child support, a complaint for modification of child support anytime there is a difference between the current order and the amount calculated under the guidelines, under the standard articulated in Morales v. Morales. So this is any time that there's any type of change to income, whether that be a job loss, disability, or a change in custody, if a child moves from living with one parent to living with another parent. And it's important to keep in mind that if the non-custodial parent doesn't modify the support when they lose their job, they're still obligated to pay the order regardless of their unemployment until they have it changed. And those arrears will continue to build up. And that debt is usually being calculated by the Department of Revenue, and they're keeping track. Also possible to file that complaint for modification, then you'll want to file a motion for a temporary order or a further temporary order in order to get that relief while the complaint for modification is pending. It's also important to keep in mind that there's no retroactive modifications except to the date of service of the complaint. See Mass General Law, Chapter 119A, Section 6, but you can ask for relief retro to the date the complaint was filed and served. But this is in the judge's discretion. And it's also important to keep in mind that because people's circumstances change, that these orders should be reviewed every couple of years to ensure that there have been no changes to the situations of the parties. So a few special circumstances to keep in mind. We talked about unemployment. So every parent should pay something, even if only the minimum order of $12 a week. And that's usually for someone who has about $210 per week in income. And DOR will garnish child support from unemployment benefits. They can also garnish child support from workers' compensation benefits, Social Security. And although they cannot garnish it from service-connected disability payments from the VA, those do count as income for purposes of calculating child support. A judge can also impute income to a non-custodial parent if they believe that they are working under the table or willfully unemployed. Another special situation is if one of the parties is receiving Social Security disability insurance, particularly if it's the based on the non-custodial parent's earnings record. In that case, there's a case called Rosenberg v. Merida that says that if the non-custodial parent receives either Social Security disability benefits or Social Security retirement benefits, and their minor children, then their minor children should receive a dependency benefit, and the non-custodial parent should receive credit for that against their child support obligation under the Rosenberg case. There are also some situations in which a court will deviate from the guidelines if, for instance, the custodial parent is remaining in the marital home and the non-custodial parent is paying the mortgage, or if there are increased travel and parenting time expenses, as we previously talked about. So something else that's usually determined at the time that a child support order is made, if done outside the Department of Revenue session, is dependency exemptions or the child tax credit. So the court can also allocate whom is able to claim the child on their taxes. This often isn't worth much for lower income households who may not pay taxes because they are below the income threshold. And this also can phase out for some higher income earners. But the tax code provides that the custodial parent gets the dependency exemption unless they relinquish it. And in order to relinquish it, you must execute IRS Form 8322. And the non-custodial parent, if claiming the child, must file that with their tax return. This also may have been phased out temporarily and replaced by the child tax credit, I believe, under the some of the COVID tax provisions. So it's very important that a client consult with a tax specialist or financial planner. So it used to be that incomes considered for purposes of calculating child support could not also be considered for purposes of calculating alimony or spousal support. Prior to the 2023 guidelines, I believe the child support guidelines applied to the first $250,000 of household income, and anything above that was used to calculate alimony. But in 2023, the Child Support Guidelines Task Force increased that income threshold to $400,000. And then we had the Kavanaugh case, which I'm sure Kate will talk about in a moment, and that sort of turned everything on its head. But child support, alimony, and property division are all interrelated in divorce cases. And it's important to focus on maximizing the resources to the family and how you allocate the support between child support and alimony. It's also important to keep in mind that child support can never be waived or bargained away by the parents in an agreement because it's in the interest of the minor children and they're not parties to the divorce agreement. And you can take a look at the McCarthy case on that point. And this is why it's always helpful to talk with a tax or financial planning professional when figuring out how to allocate support orders. And I'm gonna turn it over. Any questions first? Do we have anything in the chat, Kate?
Nope, doesn't look like it.
All right, then turn it over to you.
All right. And we'll also save some time for questions at the end. So please feel free to put them in the chat if you have any questions. Eve, would you mind? All right, thank you. All right, so I'm going to talk to everybody today about alimony. One second. All right, so you should see my screen. So alimony, what is alimony? This is, as distinguished from child support, money paid to support a former spouse. Oh, apparently the chat is disabled, but you should be able to, so if you're trying to ask questions, you should still be able to put them in the question and answer. You can't put them in the chat. You can put them in the question and answer area of Zoom, just not in the chat. All right, so alimony is money paid to a former spouse as distinguished from children. And the entire basis of alimony is that there must be a need for alimony on the recipient spouse and the ability to pay by the paying spouse. There are four types of alimony. These are laid out in General Laws, Chapter 208, Section 48. The most common one that I think most people see by far is general term alimony. And I think this is what people kind of think of when they're thinking of alimony. This is support paid regularly to a spouse who was financially dependent on the former spouse. We'll talk a bit more about this in a second, but the length of this is going to depend on the length of the marriage. And then there's three other types of alimony that do come up, although I think they are certainly less common than general term alimony. Rehabilitative alimony. This is support paid regularly to an ex-spouse who's expected to be able to support themselves by a predicted time. Maybe they're finishing. They have a clear plan for, you know, I'm going to finish my school program and then I'm going to be able to work, but I just need help for another year finishing this school program. You know, I've taken a break on my career to help raise kids and care for the home. But, you know, here's my plan for kind of getting back on my feet, getting back into the working world. I just need some help kind of financially to get there. And I think this is in a lot of ways a recognition of the reality of a lot of marriages where one spouse is really stepping out of the workforce to do more things at home, to keep the home, raise children, things like that. Reimbursement alimony is just for short-term marriages. This is for marriages that are no more than 5 years. And this is to help make up for costs that one spouse paid to the other spouse. So for example, a very short-term marriage, husband was in law school throughout that marriage, wife was working and paying husband's law school bills throughout the marriage. And then they break up right when he graduates law school. And she's like, hey, I just spent $150,000 on your law school tuition. So reimbursement alimony is there to kind of help with that situation where one spouse took a significant, you know, financial burden for the other during what turned out to be a short-term marriage. And then transitional alimony, I call this is basically to help the spouse after a short-term marriage kind of get back on their feet or settle into a new lifestyle or location. You know, one spouse picked up and moved across the country for the other spouse, spent a lot of money doing that, gave up a job and family, and then they break up a pretty short time later and the moving spouse again is like, you know, hey, I've got nothing here in Massachusetts. I just moved from California. I have no job. I haven't settled in. You're making really good money here in Massachusetts. Like maybe I moved for you. So the idea of that transitional alimony is to help the recipient spouse settle into, you know, a new lifestyle post-marriage or a new location. They need help moving back to California and getting back on their feet back in California in my scenario. So again, I think general term alimony is really what, certainly what I've dealt with most of the time. And I think what most people think of when you say alimony. The length of general term alimony is going to vary by how long the marriage was. This is laid out in Chapter 49 of Section 208. So for marriages that were short, less than 5 years, you can only get alimony for up to 50% of the time that you were married. For 5 to 10 years, you can get it for 60% of the time. 10 to 15 years, 70% of the time. 15 to 20, 80% of the time. And for a marriage of over 20 years, it can theoretically last indefinitely. There are arguments you can make that there was essentially a marital enterprise prior to the start of the marriage. You know, maybe the spouses got together in 2008. They were living together. They were one financial unit. They had three kids. The wife stayed home with those three kids. They didn't marry until 2018. They were effectively one marital enterprise for that time. Some judges will look at that and say, hey, we're going to consider this a longer marriage. We're going to look at the length of the actual marital enterprise, not base it on the date that you went and did the ceremony. We're going to base it on how long, functionally you were a marriage. But typically, for most people, it's probably just going to be the actual length of the marriage. So again, alimony is awarded when there's a need and an ability to pay. You can have need, but you don't necessarily have the ability to pay. I think most of my clients tend to be lower income. They all have need. The other person just usually doesn't realistically have an ability to pay. A person making, one spouse is making $10,000 a year and the other is making $30,000 a year. I think a lot of judges are going to say, yeah, you have unequal incomes right now, but the guy making $30,000 or the person making $30,000 doesn't have an ability to pay alimony, no matter how much the other spouse probably needs some extra financial help. So you have to look at both sides of that. So assuming there is an ability to pay, the need for support is generally the amount needed to allow the spouse to maintain the lifestyle that he or she enjoyed prior to the termination of the marriage. It's not need in like a, what do you need in order to survive? It's need, what do you need in order to enjoy the marital lifestyle? Looking at what did you have? What kind of cars did you have? What kind of living situation were you in? Where were you buying your groceries? There's a new case that says they can consider what the spouses were paying into savings. That's a new SJC case, the Openshaw case, and look at, hey, like part of this couple's budget was once a month, they contributed $1,000 into their savings account or into their stock accounts. That's part of the marital lifestyle, and that can be considered part of the recipient spouse's need. All right, so how much is alimony? If you're in court, that's probably a big thing that you're fighting over alimony. That's probably one of the big questions, is how much is the alimony going to be? So in setting the alimony amount, first the court can look at the Section 34 factors. It's the same factors they would use to divide assets. If alimony is at issue, you're going to have to list these out in every pretrial memo that you do. The length of the marriage, the age of the parties, the health of the parties, the income, employment, and employability of the parties, economic and non-economic contribution, marital lifestyle, ability of each party to maintain the marital lifestyle, lost economic opportunity as a result of the marriage, and whatever else the court considers relevant and material. So what actual amount is this going to be? Assuming general term alimony, the statute, Section 53 of the divorce statute, says 30 to 35% of the difference of the party's income. However, this is not what's used anymore in practice. That's because in 2019, the tax law changed. Alimony used to be deductible for the payor. And then in 2019, that was taken away. So that ended up having, a major effect on the impact of the alimony payments to the payor became a lot greater using those numbers. So generally used right now is going to be 23% to 28% of the difference of the party's income. And there is some pending legislation to this effect. But I think in reality, most of the family law bar and the judges are going to be looking to something in that range right now. And then all of this is subject to deviation. Judges do have the discretion to go higher, to go lower. And the way this, and just to be clear, the way the statute is worded, it says it's alimony shall be, I think, up to or at most this 30 to 35% of the income. So arguably the statute, you know, contemplates going lower than that in appropriate cases. And that 30 to 35% in most cases is going to be really the cap of where the alimony is going to end up. Although you can certainly argue to deviate upward in depending on your circumstances. So when does alimony end and can you change it? Alimony can stop if either spouse dies, if the receiving spouse of the alimony gets married again or begins living with a partner for at least 3 months, and the spouse paying the alimony reaches full retirement age, unless the judge orders something different. You can look up what your full retirement age is or what your client's full retirement age is. I think on the Social Security website, it's usually going to be around somewhere around 67. But that's when their alimony obligation is going to end. That didn't used to be the law. That was changed, I think, in maybe Eve can correct me, 2012 or 2014, if you know. If you get a very old separation agreement, somebody's, you know, someone's coming back to you and saying, I'm 70, I divorced my wife in 2005, we have this very old agreement, this very old order. You would need to actually look at what the older law was, and it's a different analysis. But for anything newer, it's going to be the alimony stops when they reach full retirement age. And you can modify alimony based on in general, unless it's waived, based on a material change in circumstances. This can actually give someone theoretically the ability to receive alimony for the first time post judgment. You know, the parties get divorced when the paying spouse is temporarily unemployed. His income is, you know, very low, so they don't do alimony at the time of the judgment. But then it was a very long marriage, and a year later he picks up a job earning $300,000 a year. The other spouse can go in and ask for a change in alimony and receive alimony for the first time after the judgment. That assumes, I'll get to this in a second, that assumes you didn't waive that ability in a separation agreement, though. Alimony waivers. So it's also, you know, in some cases, you're going to be waiving alimony as part of an agreement. The judge can't order you to waive alimony. They can't order your client to waive alimony. But in a separation agreement, the parties can agree to waive any combination that they want of past, present, and future alimony. So past would be alimony looking retroactively, getting alimony back to the date of the date the divorce was filed, for example, if you didn't get it on temporary orders in the case. Present alimony is we're going to judgment. This is the alimony that you're being ordered to pay me, you know, today and until the alimony obligation ends. Future alimony is, again, is that ability to modify the alimony order. So if you waive future alimony, you can't modify, or you have a very limited option to modify alimony in the future. I think you would essentially have to show that the other side committed some kind of fraud on their financial statement, more or less. Like if they, oh yeah, I did have that second job earning six figures that I forgot to mention. The waiver is not going to get around that kind of circumstance, but most of the time it will. So you'll see this language in separation agreements. The parties waive past, present, and future alimony. That means alimony never was and never will be paid. But again, a judge cannot make your client do that. A judge can't say, if you go to trial over alimony, the judge can't say there will never be future alimony. All right. So Eve was touching on this. Can you get alimony and child support at the same time? So here's the Alimony Reform Act. This was a big law that passed in 2012. And this had language that said the court cannot order alimony based on income that has already been used to order child support. So the husband, say, earns $2,500 a week. The wife earns $500 a week, and she gets custody of one child. So the court looks and says, okay, child support guidelines bring us to $470 a week. You can't then go under this language, and you can't then go and order alimony with husband's same income. So you've done child support. You can't do alimony now. So, you know, after this passed, I think at least some practitioners, although I think it was probably a minority view in the bar, said, well, what if you order alimony first? You know, don't do the child support first, do alimony first. First, we're going to award out of husband's $2,500, wife 28% of the difference. This comes out to $560 a week. And then we're going to take that $560 a week away from husband's income, which leaves him with $1,940 a week. And then we're going to order child support from that reduced income after you take away the alimony. And we'll add the alimony into wife's income. And that still comes out to a child support order of $368 a week. So in this situation, we've done alimony first. So we haven't ordered alimony out of income that was already ordered to use child support because we did the alimony first. I think this wasn't really, with the exception of cases that were over the cap for the child support guidelines, this wasn't really, I think, generally accepted, although some people were arguing for it. And then this Kavanaugh v. Kavanaugh decision came along in 2022. And this is a really, really important decision. You should read it if you're going to do any cases involving money in family law, which is most cases in family law. You should read Kavanaugh start to finish. And the court said, yes, you can do alimony first. And in fact, the court has to at least consider doing alimony first. In any case, virtually any case where a party is seeking alimony, the judges must engage in a three-step analysis. First, they have to, run the guidelines both ways. First, calculate alimony first, then award child support. So that's this, can you order alimony first bullet? That's what that was. Second, run the guidelines the other way. Do child support first. Because you've already used that income for child support, you can't use the same income for alimony most of the time unless you are over, you know, the cap on child support. And so that's usually going to result in a much lower order just doing child support first. And then the judges, this is where it gets, I think, really dicey and complicated and what a lot of people are kind of scared off by. The judges have to compare that those two awards and the tax consequences of each order, of each hypothetical order. And then they have to fashion an order that would be the most equitable for the family before the court, continue considering basically everything. And if the judges choose to issue an order pursuant to step two, so a child support order, or that doesn't otherwise include an award of alimony, they're supposed to articulate why they're not awarding alimony. So this has generated, I think, a lot of opinions and a lot of controversy within the bar. And judges have had a lot of different reactions to it. But, you know, if it would benefit you, if your client's going to be the one on the receiving end, this is where you should be looking. You should be arguing for that alimony first calculation and pushing for the Kavanaugh analysis if you're representing the side that is seeking alimony. And I think there's questions, this step three, does this require a tax expert? Yeah, arguably, I'm not sure I think that would be complicated to do without some kind of, you know, tax or financial advice from somebody who is not a lawyer. All right. So I think that's everything I have.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.